Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, episode 55 for April 18th, 2008. User Annoyance Control. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/windows. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. It's time for Windows Weekly, or in this case, every few weekly. But that's it on this one. I'm not going to miss another episode, I promise you, until Christmas. Paul Thurrott, well, we might because Paul's got stuff to do. Paul Thurrott is here from the Supersite for Windows. He is also the news editor for Windows IT Pro magazine and our guru for all things Microsoft. Hello, Paul.
Hey, how you doing?
I was in Tasmania, and I apologize to those who missed the show for the last couple of weeks.
This came up in a Trivial Pursuit game I was playing the other night. It was a presumed extinct animal, and I believe the answer was a Tasmanian wolf.
Tiger.
No, this was the one that... Well, no, I know there's a different...
There's a Tasmanian tiger. The xylus. Yeah, I think that's what they're talking about. The thylacine.
Okay. No one's seen it.
No one's seen it. Last one was died in captivity in 1935. But there is hope, and it's funny because this tiger is on everything. It's on the beer.
Hope. This island is the size of Rhode Island. I mean, you think
no,
someone would have
come... No, it's bigger than that. It's actually a pretty big island, and there's a lot of wilderness.
Yeah.
So there's not much hope among actual naturalists, but
sure.
You know
sure.
What's sad is the Tasmanian devil, which is, of course, is kind of its other very well-known critter, is dying out also. There's not from humans, as the thylacine was killed by farmers, but by this facial cancer that they get that is very contagious. So there's a real effort to save the Tasmanian devil. They're cute guys, but they got really sharp little teeth. So don't give them your
teeth. Like so many animals, you know. Really? Koala bears. Oh, look at the little bear.
Aww. Well, you know, there's actually pictures on my Flickr site of a wombat, which is apparently harmless. They're big. They're like the size of a small pig, but they're all furry. Right. They're like it's like what you would. It looks like the inspiration for all stuffed animals. They're really cute, little ears, little pig eyes, little round nose. And I was taking a picture of one, and it started lumbering towards me, and it's big. And I said, do these things bite? Are they dangerous?
Yeah, gut check time.
But no, they don't, and they're very cute. The animals are really neat in Tasmania. Really.
Now, you were gone for weeks, right? 2 weeks almost?
Feels like 2 weeks. Feels like a long time.
That's awesome.
So did anything happen while I was gone, you know? Any window, like any new versions of Windows?
Yeah. I didn't notice it. I don't know, not really.
No, it's been very quiet, huh?
Come
on. Windows 7 is... In fact, Paul, didn't Bill Gates practically say Windows 7's coming next year?
He supposedly said that. Actually, it turns out that's not what he said, but we should talk about that now that you mention it. He was quoted on CNET as saying, you know, he talked about Windows Vista and said the next version.
This is a shareholders meeting, Microsoft.
Well, actually, I don't think it was a shareholders meeting. I don't have it right in front of me. I can't recall what the circumstance was, but unfortunately, whatever speech he gave that day was not, you know, there's no transcript available on Microsoft.com. I looked at the time, but yeah, somebody had asked him about Vista, and he said, you know, the next version will be here as early as next year. And everyone took that to say, you know, Windows 7 is coming as early as next year. But it's not actually what he said. And then more to the point, you know, Microsoft later came back and said, look, the next version is, you know, it's still on the docket for 2010. So
he was talking about Vista, or was he talking about, I mean,
I think what he was talking about was Fiji, which is the media center update, which was supposed to be part of Service Pack 1 originally, but they delayed it because the Media Center guys were working on the Zune software. That's my theory. The part about Fiji being this next version, but that's what I think he meant. Anyway, it doesn't matter what he meant. Windows 7's not coming next year, so, you know, whatever.
Don't get your hopes up. But you have something called Windows 7 in your hot little hands.
Yeah, I have obtained an early build of Windows 7. It's not recent in any way, although it's the most recent external version, the first external version. They actually created it back in December. And over the past few months, there have been a handful of screenshots here and there. And I had gotten it about a month and a half ago. But, you know, obviously this kind of thing is, it's early and you know, I don't want to burn anybody. So I had agreed not to write about it. But over the past few weeks, there's been a lot of information coming out about that clearly came from this build. You know, I was linking to some stuff that a friend of mine, Brian, had been posting about the, you know, the five pillars of Windows 7, and I knew that he had gotten that from the build. So I contacted the guys I got it from and said, look, what do you think? And they said, yeah, go for it. You know, so I've written some information about it. I put up a bunch of screenshots. You know, I've got it on my PC now, you know, not just in a virtual machine, like actually, you know, running it. And yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. For the first thing I should point out, and I'm sure, and you, I think, mm-hmm. said this as well, is that it's kind of silly to worry too much about how it looks, since it's going to look like Vista until pretty close
yeah,
to...
Yeah, it's so easy to fall into this trap. You know, you look at this thing and you come to conclusions about it, and it's just Vista.
Right.
You know? Just like Windows XP looked like Windows 2000.
Right.
Or actually, I should say, looked different. You know, they had a different kind of skin going on until about 6 months before it shipped. You know, you can look at the thing 2 years in advance and say, oh, it does this and it does right, this, but right. None of this means anything.
Is there nothing that we can
grasp onto?
Yeah. Is there nothing we can get from this early beta?
Well, there are some hints in there, I would say, as to, you know, directions that Microsoft is going with it. I think the two biggest changes that are in there are actually digital media related. Windows Media Player 11 has been updated pretty substantially and is kind of interesting looking, but you can tell it's still sort of partway through that process. And then the version of Windows Media Center that's included has also been updated, you know, visually, and some of the subpages look different and all that. So I think there's some style things occurring there, you know, that kind of point to the future. But, you know, as for the rest of it, I most of it is just really small things. You know, did you notice there's a little icon change? It's, you know, or they've added a view style in Explorer, or, you know, they've moved some icons around, that kind of thing.
And none of that is necessarily going to, as we said, is going to persist. I mean, that's just playing with.
It's just a little clue. I mean, you can go back years to very early versions of Windows XP, which were called Whistler at the time, and you can see, you know, the very first time they put in what we now call Tile View, which is a very common Explorer view in Windows today, you can see it in those very early builds, and so you can go back and point to that and say, hey, look, you know, this carried through all the way, you know, but in the intervening years, of course, they changed everything around it, so right. Even though the view style is the same, it doesn't really tell you much.
So I guess there's nothing to say then. It's just Windows 7. Very early beta, and they're working on it. But we knew they would be working on it by now. I mean, that's a reasonable conjecture. They don't get to take a year off.
They don't just take they celebrate.
Oh, we're done. We got Vista. Let's take some time. Let's step back. Maybe they should step back. Did you see this Gartner Group report that Vista is sinking under its own weight?
No, I didn't. Please tell me about it.
So those graphics on your front page at Supersite, is Windows broken, the great Windows collapse of 2011, that has nothing to do with it. It's just a coincidence.
Oh, maybe it does.
Okay.
I don't know.
So I missed this because this came out when I was in Tasmania. What did the Gartner Group say?
I could make, you know, if I could get paid for doing just this, I could make a career out of just debunking stupidity, you know?
Analysts get paid to write this stuff.
I know. And I love that. You know, I made a very conscious decision years and years ago. You know, I don't work for, I mean, I'm not part of a big news organization or anything. I never have been. I'm a guy, you know, and I write news. I write this news digest every day. And when it was just me, literally just me, and by just me, I mean there was no company paying me to do this, and there was no, you know, parent company or anything like that. I made a decision that I would never quote analysts, you know, that I would never call someone on the phone and say, tell me what this means.
Yeah, that's lazy journalism. You see that all the time.
Yeah, and I don't know where that comes from. I think there's maybe, you know, there's some interesting issues today in mainstream journalism about the differences between news and opinion and where you have to draw the line. And I've always felt like, you know, I'm doing this thing. You're going to get my opinion. That's just part of it. And I'll tell you what I think. Right. And that maybe if you think that I'm adding some kind of value to the discussion, you'll read what I have to write instead of what someone else has to write. So I don't like to go to Gartner or...
Well, that's because you're an analyst. I mean, if you're a mainstream journalist writing for the, you know, the San Francisco Chronicle and you don't know anything about this, you might ask a supposed expert.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that I would call myself an analyst. I think of it more as I'm just involved in the industry.
Right.
And I think that my own experiences are enough that I can... you know, discuss something like this and say, hey, this is what I think is going on. I just don't like to go to other people and have them parrot something to me that I already know.
Well, let me parrot them. This is a Gartner analyst, yeah. Michael Silver and Neil McDonald at the Gartner conference in Las Vegas. They say Microsoft hasn't responded to the market, is overburdened by two decades of legacy codes and decisions, faces serious competition that will make Windows basically irrelevant unless they do something. They said, for Microsoft, its ecosystem and its customers, the situation is untenable. Windows is collapsing. How what comes next will improve? So, I have to say now, what they said kind of makes sense.
At first blush, right, that it has the ring of, okay, that makes sense. But now let's play a little game. Let's remove the word Windows and put the word Mac OS X in its place, or put the word Linux in its place, and tell me how it's any different.
Well, I will, because Mac OS X and Linux are both much... Well, Linux isn't, but Mac OS X is much newer. Much newer than Windows.
Newer than Windows, really?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
How? In what way is Mac OS X...
When was the last... When the code base we're working on is Windows NT3? NT2?
Yep. NT. Just call NT.
NT.
3. I think was the first version.
Okay. 1993.
But Windows NT, of course, is based on...
OS X is 1999, 2000?
OS X is 2001.
Okay.
But OS X is built... Wait a minute. But OS X is built on a Unix foundation and a Mach kernel. Now, I don't know exactly the date that the Mach kernel was released. Let's put it somewhere in the early 1990s. I actually have no idea. But Unix dates back to when? The 70s?
But I don't think that... I don't think the OS X has to... No, seriously. I don't think OS X has to... respond to legacy code the same way Windows does. Windows...
The biggest burden
Microsoft is under is that they have to maintain compatibility with all this crap.
But is that a burden or is that a responsibility?
Well, is it
something that makes Windows bad, or is it something that makes Windows attractive to the 1 billion people that actually do use Windows every single day?
Well, I agree. I don't think Microsoft has much choice, but this is why there's a kind of a natural life cycle of software.
Okay. No. I mean, look, we've discussed this. I actually agree with the notion that, you know, from sort of some vague technical standpoint, you could say, hey, you know, one thing Apple is able to do, because frankly, they have a pretty small user base that is actually, I would say, is in some ways, you know, this is sort of generalized, but, you know, younger and more ready to accept change and to drop things from the past.
Let's call a spade. They're fanboys. They'll do whatever Apple says.
Fine. But that's fine.
So as a result, Apple could cut the cord.
Well, no, they do something like Classic because they have to make the transition from their Classic OS, you know, OS 9, OS 8, whatever, to OS 10, which is a completely different system.
But at some point, they were willing to say to thousands, millions of users, sorry, your stuff ain't going to work anymore. And Microsoft just has a hard time.
Well, I would say they were able to say. In other words, you know, they can afford to be aggressive in that way because of the market that they...
Well, they almost have to.
Because
they're competing against Microsoft.
Now, I would just say, not to get too far off on the OS X side, but I think it's an interesting comparison, that there is also another transition occurring on the Mac side that involves the Carbon and the Cocoa APIs, right? And one of the sort of... weird side effects of what's going on there is what you might have heard that's happening with Adobe recently, where Adobe has said, we're going to come out with a version of 64-bit Photoshop, but we're going to do it on Windows. And the reason we can't do it on the Mac is because Apple doesn't support 64-bit on the library we use.
Right.
You know, they only support it on one of the two. So you might look at that and say, well, there's an example of where Apple's decisions to be very aggressive moving forward have actually harmed the platform, because now what is arguably the most maybe the most or one of the most certainly important products on that platform can't move forward easily to the next generation because of those decisions that they made.
Yeah, but who gets the heat on that? Apple or Adobe? I think Adobe gets the heat. Adobe's trying to defer it, but Adobe gets the heat. But you're right. It is Apple's. There are consequences to this. Nobody's saying that. I mean, I think Microsoft has to do what they do. It's just it is kind of endemic. That's the problem you have with success in operating systems.
Yeah. Okay. And by the way, yes. Like, I think we might have even talked about this in the past. I actually agree with you. It's a problem in some ways. Microsoft does, of course, jettison older technology. They just do it more conservatively, and they do it over a longer period of time.
Right.
So if you look at Windows Vista, you can specifically point to the 64-bit versions and say, look, here's a list of these five technologies that they've completely dropped in the 64-bit version, the hope being that maybe for the next version of Windows, 64-bit will be mainstream, and the next version after that, that stuff will just all be gone. And that's how they do it. They don't just draw a line in the sand. They kind of, you know, they move there slowly. So we get rid of 16-bit installers. We get rid of, you know, the POSIX and OS2 support and 16-bit, you know, the DOS applications and all that stuff.
I would submit that really this is what's the big difference between Linux, OS X, and Microsoft in this regard is that Windows is a business operating system. And when you're dealing with business, they're very conservative. They're very slow to move. They want to use these old, you know, line of business apps. And so you have to support that. You cannot, or you'll lose your customer base. And OS X doesn't have to worry about that. Linux doesn't have to worry about that.
Well, Linux will have to worry about that pretty soon. I mean, perhaps. I mean, not in the same exact way.
Well, there's nobody home at, hello, Linux. There's nobody there. So it's not like anyone will have to worry about it. I don't think Linus is going
to
worry about it.
Was that someone coming to your door to tell you that this was going to be the year of desktop Linux?
Hello, Linux. But that's exactly it. There isn't any business rationale, right? Because there's no business.
No, I agree with you. I would also point out that, you know, the other half of that sword when it comes to enterprises and the large businesses that are Microsoft's customer base, they also want predictability. You know, they've gone to Microsoft and they said, we want to know when you're releasing these upgrades, what's going to be involved, what you're dropping, what you're keeping, what you're adding. And we want to know in advance.
Hey, what's the richest software company in the world? This is a good business policy for Microsoft. Nobody's denying that. I guess the question is, and this is what the people say, is it a problem? Yeah.
Right. No, I don't think it is. In reading this Gartner thing, it's hard for me to read something like this because I read the article or the articles that describe what they said. And I read the words that they said at this confab that they had. And I disagree with it as I'm reading it. You know, so I read a sentence. They say, no, that's wrong. And I say, okay, I got to get through this. And I read another sentence. No, that's not either. You know, that's not right either. And it's hard for me to actually get through it. But the other thing that I remember is, I've written a story like this. I have written a story, and I wrote it for an enterprise audience, and I wrote a story, said, maybe it's time to move on. Microsoft should drop Windows and develop something new. And so I went to find it. And I thought, well, it must have been, I'm thinking, how long ago was it? 2004, 2005? You know, I searched through all my archives. Nope. And I finally found it. I wrote it exactly 6 years ago.
Wow.
In 2000. And it's called Maybe It's Time for a New Platform. And when I wrote this article, Windows XP had been on the market for about 6-7 months and had been greeted with the most unbelievable series of security vulnerabilities and exploits that had ever greeted, you know, any OS in history, which is something we all conveniently forget today, by the way, because, you know, we're too busy blasting Vista, which has experienced none of that.
Right.
So, but back then, there was this thought, you know, maybe they got it all wrong. And so I wrote this article, you know, maybe this is proof based on the way things have gone with XP that we need to start over again. And I had written something that was in many ways very similar to what Gartner's saying today, although, you know, today for slightly different reasons. But basically, what I said at the time, you know, was based on my experiences at the time. I would say years later, the changes that Microsoft has made to the Windows platform obviates what I wrote, and I think proves, or at least suggests, that what Gardner's saying is completely wrong.
In other words, it's more robust than it appears.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, for example, one of the things that they said that I called out was Michael Silver said Windows is too monolithic. You know, which you know is something that you know you can kind of say people nod along like they know what you're talking about, and then you move on to the next sentence and everyone forgets it. But actually,
what does that
Windows
mean?
Is not monolithic. Yeah, right. Windows is componentized. It's highly componentized. In fact, they componentized it for Windows Vista so that they could do this image-based deployment. They further componentized it for Windows Server 2008 so that now they can have a server core type install with no graphics subsystem. And then they're further componentizing it again for MinWin in Windows 7 so that they can have this tiny, tiny OS kernel, which is networking and a very basic, you know, text-based UI as well. Windows is not monolithic. And if anything, it's getting less monolithic over time.
Well, and that's what I've had kind of this conversation with other people, and that's what people say. Look at the hypervisor. Look at the direction that Windows is going. It's really designed to be, in a way, refreshed completely.
Sure.
And that's what the next versions of Windows with hypervisor will be.
It's also worth noting that in 2002, after all this security stuff happened, 2002, 2003, I can't remember anymore, but you know, Microsoft halted development on Windows Vista so that they could focus on fixing Windows XP and the server release they were working on at the time. And they had that kind of lockdown, the code lockdown, and where they went back and they did all the security work. They did trustworthy computing.
Right.
And the systems that have shipped since then, XP Service Pack 2, Server 2003, Windows Vista, and now Windows Server 2008, were all, you know, designed around this new way of doing things. They've completely changed Windows since 2001, 2002, and it's certainly not a monolithic system. It's crazy to suggest that it is. I just don't understand that. Now, they also, you know, I find this one kind of ironic or at least hypocritical, but they also suggested that Windows should have multiple kernels so that they can ship different versions of Windows for all kinds of different needs.
Well, doesn't Windows actually have multiple kernels?
Well, yeah, I pointed out there's several different versions of the Windows kernel. They have an embedded market, the CE, Windows
Mobile. And also when you install Windows, I don't know if it's true with Vista anymore, but it was true with XP. It would look at the hardware, and if you had...
It
would install different kernels depending on what your capabilities were.
Well, you could even just look at hardware platforms and say, well, you know, the version running on X64, Itanium, you know, X86, whatever.
That's compiled for a different... Yeah.
The thing that I find is really interesting about that, you know, one size doesn't fit all, you know, the guy said, and I would just point out on the side that, you know, when Apple moved the Mac OS X kernel down to a phone, everyone applauded,
right?
You know, but these guys are arguing the exact opposite.
These are the same guys who probably criticized Microsoft for having 7 SKUs for Windows Vista.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One size fits all. No, they had.
Size fits all.
But you have too many SKUs.
So I find this stuff sort of crazy. The other thing I would just say is that, you know, they focused on 3 areas, and I wrote a separate article where I sort of approached it from the standpoint of the enterprise, and I published this in an enterprise newsletter, and I asked people to write me back and say, seriously, tell me if I'm crazy. You know, tell me if I'm not getting this right. You use, deploy, and support Windows every single day. Do you agree with these guys? You know, and they pointed out 3 areas where Windows was lacking: legacy support compatibility, right? Increased complexity, and then hardware compatibility. So I figured legacy support could break that into software and hardware compatibility, right? We already talked about the backwards compatibility stuff. Windows, if anything, is backwards compatible. So clearly, this is a non-starter. Enterprises want this stuff to work on what they're already using. Simple. Windows is backwards compatible.
Right.
Very simple.
Right.
And you can talk about the incompatibility stuff with Windows Vista, but let's be serious. There's real-world data that will show that Windows Vista is, in fact, more compatible with legacy hardware than any other version of Windows that came before it. Every version of Windows is going to be problems. There were problems with XP. There were problems with 2000. There were problems with NT4. That's what happens. But
how do you account for then the perception that there are a lot of people don't like Vista?
Very easily, because we live in this interconnected world where blogging has replaced news, where everyone's opinion is out there for everyone to read. And if you're some hotshot tech blogger type guy, it's Windows is a nice, convenient target that you waited and waited and waited for. And now because it's so late and it arrives and it's that same thing you were playing with 2 years ago, you're bored by it and you're mad at Microsoft for not making you excited.
Yeah, that's true.
And you can just blast them into the blogosphere.
So Do you think that most people are happy with Vista? In fact?
Yeah, I think it's the silent majority, you know, yeah. And that I would say as of this day, there were probably over 100 million people actually using Windows Vista. And that, as is the case in any customer service scenario, you don't hear from the people that get up every day, use it, and then get on with life because it just works and they don't think about it.
Right.
But what you do hear about is the guy who's like, hey, it doesn't work with my printer. What the hell? I have to go back to XP.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff. There's another thing going on with XP, and I think we, you know, it's been a while. I think we might have talked about this, where I really think that people's feelings about XP have more to do with human nature than they do with technology. You know, I think we've hit this interesting point now with XP where we're comfortable with it. You know, it's a sweatshirt, you know, in the closet that we all love, and it's ratty and it's dirty, but it's comfortable but and it fits it. And we're not throwing it away, you know,
and every one of those blood stains comes from a real world experience.
That's right. I can point to them and tell you exactly how they happened, you know, but I think there's some human nature involved there as well. And I, you know, and it's understandable. It's fine. But, you know, as I've said so many times, I have a hard time when I go down to XP, because I do miss stuff in Vista. And I think that a lot of the stuff that's been written about Vista is unfair, but I think it's coming, you know, it's coming from a place that doesn't really serve the people who are reading the stories, because right. You're a techie geeky guy and right. You care about technology for technology's sake, and you're not really putting yourself in the position of the people who really
of real world users. Yeah. Now, what about this? Because this is coming right from Microsoft. David Cross, product unit manager at Microsoft, says to ZDNet, the reason we put user access control into Vista was to annoy users. I'm serious, end quote.
Right.
But this is what you were talking about earlier. This is like putting kernel protection in 64-bit. Mm-hmm. He said we wanted to change the ecosystem, to get developers to change their habits.
Yeah. Yeah, no, right. User account control is supposed to be annoying, and it is. And I look at that like, it is. It works. I mean, good. So you've made people behave differently. You've made people pay attention.
But not just people. It's also aimed at developers.
But let's just talk. I mean, just talking user account control. The idea is you're trying to get work done, and all of a sudden it goes beep, and your screen goes black, and this dialogue comes up. And you actually have to look at it and think about it. Hey, you just downloaded some stupid utility from the internet. Right. Are you sure you want to install this thing? Right. Really? You know, and you have to think about it. You know, the funny thing about user account control is that the arguments about it, which are so wrongheaded, you know, that it comes up, pops up too often and happens all the time, is the type of thing that only happens when you have a new system and you're installing software and you're configuring things. I mean, after a week or two, you've pretty much done that and you're done. User account control will only occur very infrequently after that. And they have data to prove that, you know, but whatever. It's amazing to me that people will review software based on that first day or two of experience.
Yeah, that's just lame.
And that's the depth that they go to, right?
I have to say, though, I mean, there's things about user account control, like user access control. Like, for some reason, when I try to delete desktop icons, it often asks me for an administrator password. That's just silly.
It doesn't go away.
That's been doing that ever since day one. I don't know why.
Listen, you can go back and you can look at the articles I wrote about user account control during the beta. This was a source of contention for me with Microsoft because I really felt like they were getting it wrong, and that, you know, all you have to do is look at, say, Mac OS X, not to keep bringing up Apple, but to look at Mac OS X, which has had a user account control type feature for a long, long time, and say, look, this is how you do it right. You know, and since the beta, they've improved it. It's still a little on the heavy handed side. But as that guy noted, Cross, it was by design, you know,
he wanted to piss him off. he wanted to wake people up. Yeah.
You got to remember, you know, hundreds of millions of people have a decade of experience of getting up in the morning, turning on their computer, and doing whatever the heck they want, right. No matter how dangerous it is,
right.
With no warning and no sense of, you know, what you're doing is wrong. So, you know, this is going cold turkey. That's what this is. This is about getting people to behave differently. Unfortunately, it's not always easy to do that. So it requires this kind of brute force approach. And I think it's fine. I use Windows every single day in a variety of machines. I've never turned off user account control.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, other than to test that, you know, to see that it works.
No, I leave it on. No, you're right. I leave it on. I'm not even tempted to be honest.
I mean, I hate myself. You know, maybe that's part of the reason. No,
it's seriously. You love the pain.
It's just, yeah, I'm a masochist, exactly.
Yeah, hurt me.
Of course, I also scream at my computer. Yeah. The point is, it's, you know, it really isn't that bad once you're up and running.
Yeah.
You know, once you install stuff, you configure it the way you want. I mean, are you really installing things every single day?
No.
I mean, if you are, maybe you need to think about some other stuff that you could be doing differently. I don't know.
You just got a new computer from a new shuttle. How do you like it? Mm-hmm. What'd you get? You said the KPC?
Yeah, shuttle KPC. I like it a lot. You know, I've been investigating these small, inexpensive machines. I wrote something about the EPC a while ago. I have that.
And now they have that new 900. Now, of course, the minute I bought the old EPC, now they've got the new one. But
yeah. Right. Yeah, I could use a bigger one.
I've had shuttle. I have a shuttle. I really like my shuttle.
I've always been fascinated by shuttle PCs and by small form factor computers in general for a long time.
Yeah.
I have this notion in the back of my head, and unfortunately it's been confirmed by this machine that they're not as quiet as you would want them to be.
No.
You
know?
And I don't quite get that, you know. You know, a Mac Mini, for example, which certainly is more expensive than this shuttle computer. And it, you know, is considerably quieter despite being smaller.
Yeah.
Which I find confusing. So it's not that it's not a huge racket, but this type of computer, because of its size, you know, it's like a little toaster. You kind of wish you could put it up on the desk and just leave it there, but it's loud enough that
right.
You actually want to move it under the desk.
Yeah. I did have the same problem with my shuttle. In fact, for the radio show, it was almost a little too noisy. But these are right. these KPCs are very affordable.
Yeah, the version I got was $299, and you know, it comes with a gigabyte of RAM. You can upgrade it to 2 gig for $15. So I did do that. Unfortunately, that's the max. So it's an interesting trade off if you want to run Vista on there. But it has the version I have is a Pentium dual core chip. You can get a Celeron on the low end. You can get a version without any processor. And I think you can get a dual, Intel Core 2 Duo on the high end. Usually it comes with an 80 gig hard drive. Right now they're giving out 160 gig hard drives for free. It comes with a version of Linux I've never heard of called Foresight Linux, but actually it's pretty good. It's got the GNOME desktop environment. It's got those cool kind of, you know, special effects like the arrow type effects they have in Vista. But of course it's on Linux, so they kind of take it to the nth degree. I think it's called Compiz, maybe, or Compiz, I think is the name of it. It's basically a compositing engine. Mm-hmm. So as you drag Windows around, they actually flap like a flag in the breeze, you know, which is really neat at first and then gets old about 10 seconds. Yeah. But it's a cool effect. I mean, it's like, so the one big lack on these is there's no way to get one with a drive, an optical drive, built inside, so you have to use a USB optical drive.
They're that small. Wow.
Yeah, and it seems like there'd be plenty of room for one. I'm a little confused by that. The other thing I find a little odd is that there's, I think there are 4 USB ports, but they're all in the back. So you can't just pop something in the front,
right?
Which is a little odd. But, you
know,
$299.
They do their own motherboards, and I think that's part of the way that Shuttle works is, you know, it's kind of, they're just a little more limited.
Yeah.
But it's a good price. Boy.
Yeah. So actually, Foresight Linux, you know, again, as a second computer, as a computer for kids, as a computer that you will use primarily for cloud computing. So maybe you'll be launching Firefox and running, you know, Gmail, Google Calendar, Google Docs, stuff like that. I mean, this is more than enough computer. It's amazing. It's absolutely great for that kind of thing. I did blow out the Linux install to see what else I could put on there. I tried to put XP on there, but it just basically X'd out at some point during setup. And I think that has to do with the USB drive, you know, the optical drive. So I'll play with that later, but I'm told that XP will work. I did install Windows Vista on there.
Really?
And actually 2 gigs of RAM. I mean, I suppose you could use a USB memory card, you know, get some Ready Boost going on there. Right. It would be fine. But I would say even for a, you know, like a cloud computing type thing or word processing, you know, you're not going to play games on it. It has some sort of integrated graphics, but you know, for just normal desktop use, you know, business computing or cloud computing, that kind of thing. Even Vista's fine on here. It's great.
I wish it were quieter because I'm looking for small dedicated machines for the new studio. You know, I want to have only one machine do Skype, one machine do this, one machine do that. And these would be perfect. I could stack them up. And
yeah. Right. Well, what I would look at then is I'd wait to see what Apple does with the Mac Mini. And unfortunately, yeah. I mean, they're literally twice as expensive as right. this thing. But those they're are quiet. These laptop yeah. parts, you know.
Yeah, I have a Mini that I'll probably use as one of those.
Yeah.
Devices.
The only thing I found with the Mini though is you got to keep them clean because they get gunked up and then they start to, you know.
Yeah. Software clean or dust free?
No, you need the spray. You know, you got to get in there.
Really?
Yeah.
Spray it? Wait a minute. Yeah. What are you talking
over
about?
The air.
The compressed air. Okay, I get it. Yeah. Oh, okay. I get it.
What do you think I meant?
I don't know. Windex. I don't know. I couldn't figure it out.
Windex, yeah. No, you put it in the dishwasher.
I did that.
No,
it works really well, but not with my Mini, only with the keyboard.
No, not with the Mini. Well, we'll get there. Pretty soon they'll all be dishwashable.
You know, that's not a bad idea.
And actually, this reminds me, we should mention that the last time we spoke, I mentioned the Windows Server 2008 Enterprise Edition giveaway. I'd like to point out now that the giveaway is over.
It's been given away, okay?
It's been given away and delivered and, you know, PayPal'd me for the shipping already. So please don't write me about it anymore.
Well, you give away stuff. You hear from people.
Yeah. Well, I gave away the HD DVD drive for the Xbox 360, and I got, you know, several emails, maybe. I don't know how. Not many, let's say. And then I gave away Windows Server 2008, and I got over 2,000 emails.
Well, there you go. That shows you how much more valuable it is than HD DVD. Yeah.
The problem is, you know, 75% of them arrived after I'd already awarded it to somebody because I was going to use the first 100 entries as the, you know, the basis for the contest, which
right.
I did.
Right.
And I used a random generator, a random number generator. I think it was on random.org, if I remember correctly, to arrive at the number.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was so long ago, I have a hard time remembering it, except that as we're recording this, I will open up my email and I will have gotten another email about the Windows Server 2008, which is too bad. So the next time I do something like this, I'll mention a date that it will be
it's
over.
It's hopeless, Paul.
Yeah.
Trust me. It's just hopeless. You can't. I still get email. I offered at the beginning of the year a desk calendar with Merlin Mann's quips in it, and I still get email. People say, can you send me that calendar?
Well, I like to respond to email when I can, and I can't respond to every email I got about this giveaway. So
people understand.
Yeah,
you're responding en masse right now. Thank you for your email. We appreciate your interest. We've given it away.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Your email is important to me.
Press one if you
I have to clear it's gonna I don't know how I'm ever gonna clear this out of my inbox.
Oh, it's going to, I'm telling you, because the nature of podcasting, people will listen to that show a year from now and send you an email saying, oh, I'd like that.
Right. Windows 2008 will, in fact, have been supplanted by three other versions. You know?
I'd like that. Oh, that's why you're giving it away.
Yeah. Well, oh well. So,
live and learn, Paul.
I'm trying.
Next time you'll do caller 9 and it'll be over.
Maybe that's how we should do it. We'll do the live show next time.
Yeah, we're starting to do, you know, once I get this whole thing set up, I'm still working on the downstairs studio, and we got the T1 now. And, you know, it's funny. I'm ready to go, except that the desk, I ordered this very big U-shaped desk that's going to be kind of home base. They didn't send the screws, so everything's ready.
Nice.
But for the want of a screw, I can't. How many times have I said that? For the want of a screw, I could be, but no.
You could be on the deck of the Enterprise.
I could be on the deck of the Enterprise, and I just need a screw. So as soon as we do that, but at that point, I think a lot of the times, in fact, I probably plan on doing it every time. We'll always have people watching and listening as we record. So we could do that, you know, caller 9 kind of thing, and just get it done.
Where are you with the relation to San Francisco? Are you north of San Francisco?
I'm an hour north, yeah.
And is it near Sonoma?
Yeah, we're in Sonoma County. Why?
Okay. Oh, you are. Oh, because I think I'm coming out there in July.
See? You'll be... Oh, great! You'll be on the show. People will see you. I'll have a chair just for you, Paul.
I'll put a bag on my head.
That would be fun. The unknown pundit. It'll be good. It'll be good. You could be a character, recurring character. Oh, good. Yeah, come out. And it's great wine country, and I'll show you the best coffee, and we'll have a good time.
Yeah, we're going to visit Sebastiani.
Oh, fantastic.
Vineyards are.
Yeah, that's very, you know, we're in Sonoma County, so you'll be in my neck of the woods.
There you go.
I look forward to it.
Okay.
That's my plan. You know, my hope is, because we are a little out of the way, we're a little far from San Francisco, mm-hmm. that I can get people to come up here and be part of it. Because, you know, I mean, it's not... Well, it's, I don't just want...
You'll probably know this. It was at Santa Clara, or there's an airport up there that when I look for flights, it actually doesn't have me go to San Francisco. It has me go through...
You can fly into Santa Rosa, yeah.
Santa Rosa, okay.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because that only has flights from Seattle and Vegas.
I believe they actually pull a glider behind a plane.
I think you're exactly right.
Land it yourself.
And they let you go. You're here.
You follow the sun.
You're here.
And see the water. You should land.
Hey, let's get an Audible pick, and then we'll get your software of the week and your Vista tip of the week. Have you? Audible, of course, is our sponsor. We do thank them for their support. Audible.com is the place to go. And if you go to audible.com/windows, you can get a free book if you're not already a member. I know almost everybody listens now as a member. I think we've saturated the audience.
Right,
but if you're one of the few who hasn't yet joined up, this is a great chance to get a free book. And we always like to recommend, kind of do a little book report on what we're reading these days.
Oh, my life.
There's Mr. Audible. Don Katz is calling you. Hello, Paul.
You know, if we had been recording this every week, I would have remembered to.
You see?
Nope. I can't turn it off.
Is it something important? You could take it.
I don't know. It says incoming call. It doesn't sound important.
I hate that. If you don't have caller ID turned on, I'm not going to answer your call.
Yeah.
I don't understand why
those calls even come through, to be honest with it.
Well, you can't. I think you can go call the phone company and you could block. They have a system. At least they did out here. They had a system.
Really? Because when I call the phone company, they laugh.
This was good.
They're like, no, that sounds great. That's a great idea. We should do that.
No, I was getting harassing calls for a while, so I turned this on, and it didn't work because none of our friends had caller ID turned on, and they got annoyed. But what it said is, I'm sorry, but Leo isn't accepting calls unless you have caller ID turned on or you'll identify yourself now. And then you'd have to identify yourself.
And the guy says, it's me again.
It's me. and it worked great, but it just annoyed. In fact, there was one particular friend who just said, I'm not going to identify myself. And she never called. So anyway.
Well, maybe we could have a reunion show with her sometime this year.
Jeez. So audible.com. I don't know how we got off on that tangent. Because your phone rang. audible.com/windows. And what are you reading these days, Mr. Thurrott?
Oh, man. Since we last talked.
Yeah.
I'm all over the map. No, I have different things going on, you know, books, I get e-books, but I got something called Fatherland by Robert Harris. This is a one of those alternate history type books.
Oh, I love that stuff.
Yeah, so it's 1950s Germany. They've won World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this a city, I think it's just called Germania, which is sort of the Berlin of the future. It's the Berlin that Hitler envisioned, you know, with the arch that would, you know, that the Arc de Triomphe would fit under, the, you know, the huge dome the Vatican would fit within, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I looked this thing up. I have a real kind of World War II / history streak. So there's a lot of us stuff going on there, but I came across this because of that. And I believe that it was Albert Speer, who was the architect who was working on this stuff for Hitler, the model of this city still exists, and it's on display now somewhere in Germany, I think probably in Berlin.
Wow. Wow.
And I saw pictures of it in the newspaper. This is fascinating. And I looked it up and I came across this, and I'd heard of the book and I didn't really understand what it was. So the audiobook version of it is actually a dramatization, which is something I've never tried before, but this one sounded kind of interesting.
I love them. I do a lot of those now. Yeah.
There's also a movie version of it starring Rutger Hauer, but unfortunately it's not available on DVD. You can get it on VHS. So I'll look for that, you know, some point down the road, but I want to go through the book first. And anyway, it looks interesting. And I just kind of got into it recently, as I often do when I recommend these things. But
if you want to read a similar book, of course, I think I recommended it before. It's The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. Same idea. It's an alternate history. The Germans have won the war. They partitioned the United States. The West Coast is owned by the Japanese. The East Coast is owned by the Germans. Man in the High Castle is a dissident and risks his life speaking out against the Nazis. It's really, I love alternate histories. They really grab you. So our pick of the week is Fatherland by Robert Harris. There's a BBC dramatization of this, so you can. I love those dramatizations. I have to say they're really a great way. It's like, you know, it's radio theater. Which I
yeah, it reminds me of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah,
that they did. And then in on the other end of the spectrum, I had heard in Dallas one time they did a radio kind of a radio play version of Left Behind, which I don't think was supposed to be funny, but I found it very humorous for some reason.
I have read a Robert Harris book. I have read a Robert Harris book, which in fact I listened to it on Audible called Pompeii, which was kind of the history of Pompeii, not history, but it's a novel about Pompeii that was great. Yes. Loved it. And the volcano erupts. And oh,
he wrote Imperium as well. I think it was probably about Rome. I haven't read it, but I had seen a bunch of his books, you know, in looking this one up. And I thought, oh, if this is going
to
work.
Pompeii's good. I listened to Pompeii and I really liked it. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that's our Audible pick of the week. It's Robert Harris's Fatherland or Vaterland by Robert Harris and the BBC. And they are in charge. We are in charge. If you would like to get this book free, go to MacBreak. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Wow. Is that a slip?
Wow.
Go to.
Let me just spin the chamber in this guy.
I'm still a little jet lagged, I confess. Audible.com/windows. I don't know what that Mac thing is. Audible.com/windows. We love Audible.
It sounds
I know you will
cute,
too.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it's going to be cute. If you haven't tried audiobooks, you got to give them a try. If you love podcasts, you're an audiobook listener, and Audible is the one. The only, the best, audible.com. We thank them for their support. Windows Weekly. So time for, let's do the software pick first. What do you say? You
got one? Actually, let's not do the software pick first.
Let's not. Let's do the tip. You want to do the tip first?
The tip kind of follows the tip, I guess.
Perfect.
The pick follows the tip.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. It sounds like it'd be a good... good song.
Now, because of what I've been doing lately, I'm working on the revision to Windows Vista Secrets, the book. So actually, you know, us being off for a couple of weeks has worked out because this is, you know, basically all I've been doing in my spare time. It's been kind of horrific. My wife actually took the kids away on a mini vacation so I could stay home and just, you know, plow ahead here. But
wow.
I have, you know, a variety of computers here and, but I have this main system that I use. So I decided, you know, one of the things I don't typically recommend this to people as a matter of course, but you know, of course you can dual boot on various systems and boot between different versions of the operating system. If you want, you know, on Windows Vista, for example, one of the things you can do that I don't think people really appreciate is you can, using the disk that you've got with the PC or if you bought it retail, you can actually reinstall the operating system again and again and again. And in fact, one of the things that's really interesting about Windows Vista is because it comes in several different product versions, you can actually install and check out for 30 days any of the versions. You know, so if you're running Windows Vista Home Premium, you could install Ultimate and just kind of check it out for 30 days. And then at that point, you could decide to upgrade or you could just wipe it out and start again.
Yeah. How do you roll back? Do you actually format the disk or is there an easier way?
Yeah, you'd have to get rid of it. Yeah. You would pretty much have to get rid of it. But the tip, such as it is that you don't have to wipe out what you're doing. You can actually just dual boot. And one of the things that all modern versions of Windows offer is if you install two or more copies of the operating system in different partitions, or different hard drives on one PC, it will create this menu for you so that you can choose which system to boot to when you boot it, you know, when you turn on the computer. And I think that for Vista specifically, because a lot of people are going to get Windows Vista with whatever version they may get. They may get business for, you know, the business edition. They may get home basic or home premium, whatever it is. They'll get whatever they get. So if you do get anything other than Ultimate, you might want to check out some of the other versions because you might actually want to upgrade. And of course, one of the things that's interesting about Vista as well is that there are so many different ways you can upgrade that can be mind-boggling as well. But one of the least expensive ways is to buy something called the Windows Anytime Upgrade. And this used to be electronic, which was really cool. But that ended about 2 weeks ago because Microsoft found that a lot of typical consumers were confused by them emailing them a product key.
Oh, really?
And then not getting anything in the mail. But I always thought that was great because if you already had the disk, it was sort of like instant gratification.
I didn't know they turned that off. I agree. Yeah. I thought that was a really cool feature.
Apparently, there were just too many problems. You know, they would mail out a product key, and then the people would lose it or not understand what to do with it, and then they would get complaints. And I don't understand why they don't just do both, but now they've cut that off so that the only way you can get Windows through this program is to order it. And you can actually, it's interesting, you can buy it directly from Microsoft. You can go on to Amazon.com and order from them a Windows Anytime upgrade. And they're very specific. You have to get the version that's for your system. So if you have Home Basic, there are two different Anytime upgrades you can get. There's one that will take you to Home Premium, and then there's one that will take you to Ultimate Edition. Of course, there's different costs involved and all that kind of stuff. But I've been going over this stuff for the book. And in fact, I bought a version of Anytime upgrade. I bought a version of the retail upgrade. And, you know, I have to test all the different upgrade scenarios and test all the different ways that you can install Vista. And it just occurred to me again that, you know, one of the cool things you can do with Vista, if you want, is just install it again. You know, and if you want to, for whatever reason, I'm having trouble off the top of my head thinking of why you might want to do this, but you could conceivably install the same exact operating system version, you know, three different times and probably activate it on this because the hardware is the same. And it would probably activate fine all three times because it's the same hardware. And for whatever reason, you may want to do, you know, three different installs of the same OS. You could do that too. So it's, I guess the tip is just remember that you can dual or multi-boot. Install as many copies of Windows as you want. You have to have the free hard drive space, of course. An additional hard drive is always better, but you can partition the hard drive however you want. On my particular system, I have this ridiculous partitioning scheme, which I'm not particularly proud of, but I've got, you know, I've got Vista 32-bit, I've got Vista 64-bit, I've got Windows Server 2008 64-bit, and Windows 7 32-bit.
I think you need more computers.
I know. Well, I'm trying to keep things to a minute. I do have a stupid number of computers in here too, but that's the type of thing that goes up and down over time. You know, I was taking screenshots today for the book, and I had four different computers running with different things.
Golly.
Stupid. Anyway, the software pick is related to this because one of the problems with Windows Vista is that the boot menu is not easily editable. You know, in previous versions of Windows, Windows XP, Windows NT 4.0 specifically, Windows 2000, the file that controlled what the boot menu looked like was a simple text file. So you could go in, hand edit it, you could make it say whatever you want. Now, the problem with Windows Vista is if you install two copies of Windows Vista, one is the 64-bit version of Ultimate and the other one is the 32-bit version of Ultimate, when you go to the boot menu, it says Microsoft Windows Vista, Microsoft Windows Vista.
You can't tell.
There's never any indication which one is which, except that the one you install last will be the one that's being selected by default.
Yeah, but you got to remember that.
You got to remember that. And within Windows, there isn't a tool where you can edit this thing in a plain text fashion, and there isn't a graphical tool where you can edit the menu, although there is a command line tool, which is horrific, and I don't recommend for anybody.
It used to be. Is it different from the way it was in XP? Because in XP, there used to be that, what was it, boot.ini?
Yeah,
and you could edit the boot.ini.
It's gone.
It's not the same. Oh.
Yeah. It's BCE now, and it's a different style of doing it. But there's a tool called Vista Boot Pro, which you can find at vistabootpro.org. And it just gives you a really nice graphical interface. You can change the items. You can change what they say. So, you know, of course, in mine, it will say, you know, Windows Vista Ultimate X64, so I can tell what that is.
Start
and you can also
dummy.
Change the order. Yeah. Well, you want to, you know, it should be obvious.
Yeah.
And you can also change the order. So if you want, you know, you could, if I have, I think it's four items, four different operating systems that I'm booting between, maybe the third one down the list is the one that's the default. And that's fine. You can do it that way. But you could also move that one to the top, you know, just to make it even more obvious that this is the default, although it will be selected regardless. So anyway, Vista Boot Pro, it's a great tool. It's free. It does exactly what you want it to do. And if you're dual booting or multi-booting with Vista, whether it's between two or more versions of Vista or Vista with any other operating system, this is the tool to get. It's fantastic.
So this will handle, if you have a Linux boot as well, it supports them all.
No.
Oh,
sorry. No,
okay.
I didn't explain that adequately. No, it will handle any version of Windows. So I haven't done a dual boot with Linux in quite a while, but assuming it works the same way that it did before, you would typically install Linux last. Linux would put its bootloader, which today is probably Grub, I guess,
on the front. And that would say, now load Windows, and then you'd get
and
Windows
then
boot.
The Windows bootloader would come next. But I have, you know, again, I haven't tried that in a while, but I will say that if you are going to boot between different versions of Windows, it always makes sense to install the oldest version first. And that was true back in the days when the 9X operating systems were around, but it's true today too. So, you know, the bootloader in Windows XP, like you said, in previous versions of Windows, the boot INI, is an older style bootloader, you should install those systems first and then move down the line. So when I installed on my system, I actually tried to get XP on here, but I couldn't because of some sort of hardware incompatibility. So I did the Vista versions first. I did Windows Server 2008 next, and then I did Windows 7 last, figuring that if there had been any changes, it always makes sense to do the newest one last.
Right. But that's, yeah, and that's because the new ones know about the old ones, but the old ones don't know about the new ones.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Yes. So you'll get, it, you know, if you install Windows 98 after Vista, it's not going to see Vista. It's going
to
be...
If you were to install Windows 98 regardless of Vista at this point, yeah. We'd have some things to talk about.
You got your own problems.
Okay. Look, I know Vista's slow, but come on.
Come on. Well, that was a fabulous, fabulous episode of Windows Weekly, number 55. We are going to be back next week, and I'm going to be pretty much, you know, I don't have any travels planned until 2000. Well, actually, Christmas, we're going to go to France.
Wow.
Maybe we could do the show in France.
Listen, it wouldn't take much.
I know. You love France. Well, my daughter, actually, I'm really proud of my daughter. My daughter applied. She's a junior, be a junior next year in high school. Applied for a... foreign exchange thing. It's called School Year Abroad, and she's going to be in Rennes, which is in Brittany, nice. The capital of Brittany, next year. So we're going to go. She stays with a host family, a French family, and we'll go visit them at Christmas. We've already got our hotel reservations in Rennes. It's a couple hours from Paris, I think, but maybe we could. It'd be kind of fun.
Yeah,
do the show from a Parisian cafe.
Oh. Vista, it stinks. What are you using Vista for?
Wow.
You Americans, you do not know. Vista is like bad cheese.
Oh my.
So what the point of this is that I don't expect to miss any episodes for a while now.
You're talking Christmas, so I,
well, you must have some travels. I mean, you're always out and about. But.
Yeah, so I don't have anything planned. Tech Ed's in June. My wife is going to France, but I'm not going on that trip in May to visit some friends who are moving.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I get away a lot. It's okay.
All right.
We're going to Ireland in the summer, but
oh, that'll be fun. Yeah. Well, we may miss some episodes then, but that's all right. We could find not a replacement for you, Paul, because you're irreplaceable. But maybe I don't know, Brian or somebody could come on the show when you're not around.
Anything is possible.
You don't sound too excited about that.
Anything is possible. No, we could get sure. I mean,
yeah, whatever. What the hell,
Ed Budd.
Ed Bott's great. I love Ed. Ed and I go way back. He used to be a regular on the radio show that we did. I guess we talked about this when he was on with Dvorak.
Right.
When he was at PC. I guess he was at PC World. Anyway, it's time to wrap up. I'm dragging it out. I just don't want to leave. You probably need some coffee. I need to go get lunch.
I have to go to my son's birthday party today. So.
Oh, happy birthday. Oh, that's is today his birthday?
No, they were away, so they put the birthday party back, so it's a few weeks.
Have
not
fun.
Quite 2 weeks.
Have fun. Tell him happy birthday from some guy he never met and doesn't care the least.
That guy that prevents him from playing on the Xbox on Thursday afternoon.
That guy!
That's because that's basically who you are.
That's who I am.
Last week, when he discovered I wasn't recording my podcast, I believe he actually said, yes!
Great. Great. So, what games are you playing these days?
Call of Duty 4, still primarily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My son's big into that. And
Rainbow Six.
I avoided Guitar Hero for the longest time because I wanted him to play an actual guitar. Mm-hmm. But I finally broke down, and he's loving Guitar Hero. He just loves it.
I find Guitar Hero very difficult.
It's too hard for grown-ups. You have to be...
I think I am... Yeah, I'm lacking in some form of coordination.
No, you're just normal.
Yeah.
It's tough. I watch him play on the... Even the extreme level's impossible. Even the hard level, I go, wow.
Oh, I would be happy to get through a song. And easy. I've done it a few times, on the simplest level.
Me too.
Hey, I finished a song.
All right. Go practice, Paul. We'll see you next week on Windows Weekly.